You're listening to the podcast, Send Me. Here with you is host, Jason Sweet.
Constant forward movement.
What career field are you going for, Romeo Sierra?
How bad do you want what you're trying to accomplish?
Put
that extra effort in.
1, 2, 3.
Brought to you by SOCOM Athlete. Send Me.
You're tuned in to the Send Me podcast by SOCOM Athlete. This is your host, Jason Sweet. Thanks for tuning in. And I'm here with a very special guest tonight and my close friend, retired Navy SEAL officer Isaiah Staley, who is a former Air Force PJ and Air Force Combat Rescue Officer. He's one of the few people in history to go through both BUDS and pararescue training and can really give you a glimpse of which one was more challenging for him, which elements were more challenging, and the cultural difference behind a career field like pararescue and a career field like the Navy SEALs. He's been a loyal friend to me. He's one of those guys that have always kept in touch throughout the years. When I was first getting SOCOM Athlete off the ground as a company, he was there to show up for our hell days as an instructor, driving across multiple states. He was there to help us create the Navy SEAL Elite Prep Program and other programs as a resource to look over them with his experience. He's been to a total of 4 of our Hell Day events as a special guest, and he turns it up and brings the fear to these candidates. So let me fill you in on this beast. He has 9 deployments, 6 as a PJ, to Kosovo, Iraq, and 4 to Afghanistan. 2 as a Crow, both of those to Afghanistan, and 1 deployment to Iraq as a Navy SEAL officer, lieutenant. Staley is in incredible shape and an elite athlete, so much that he was chosen by US SOCOM, which is Special Operations Command, to compete in the Warrior Games. And lastly, he is the only combat rescue officer in history to cross over into the Navy and become a Navy SEAL officer. There has not been a Navy SEAL officer crossover into the Air Force to become a combat rescue officer, so that makes Isaiah's career path very unique. And it also means that he is one of the only individuals, if not the only individual in the world, that can give unbiased personal advice and personal information based on his experiences as both a combat rescue officer / pararescueman and a Navy SEAL. Isaiah, my man, thanks for coming on with us tonight. How are you?
Good, man. Great to be here. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Isaiah, let's just get right into it. How'd you hear about pararescue and what led you into the Air Force in the first place?
Came in pretty quick right after high school. No great story there other than right about graduation time, postcard shows up in the mailbox, got a jet on it, little aim high thing going on. Why the Air Force? Why not? I figured I'd end up in college wasting my time, so go do something while I figure out what I wanted to do. So I actually went in as a jet engine mechanic.
So how old were you when you enlisted?
Went in at 18 years old.
What were you planning on doing before that? Where did you kind of see yourself going in life before the Air Force presented itself to you in that postcard?
Pretty lost soul. I mean, that's why I skipped out on college. I figured I'd end up there partying and wasting my time. So at least going in the Air Force would give me maybe direction, give me something that you could carry through with you for the rest of your life, and then pick up on college later when I figured out what I wanted to do or study.
So you found out about the Air Force and you took, I guess, what we would call a regular job. Is that correct?
Well, I went in as a jet engine mechanic. It was in basic training that they did some presentation for pararescue. Now, what happened there is the TI had told us all, don't even bother trying out. You're not going to make it. So I took that as a direct challenge. Went there, ended up number one student at the tryout, and got my order switched while I was in basic.
So what was the tryout, Isaiah? Was this the typical pass test, 1.5-mile run on a track, 500-meter swim, push-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups for time, and a couple 25-yard underwaters?
Everything minus the underwaters. It's pretty vanilla, basic run, swim, push-up, pull-up, sit-up.
So what was your background in physical training? Did you have any experience in the pool? Did you have any experience as an athlete beforehand, or...?
I swam competitively till I was about 8 years old, but grew up in Hawaii, so you're always in and out of the water. Not a competitive swimmer, but decent enough, comfortable enough in the water. Played a lot of soccer and wrestling.
So you went out there and you passed that pass test, and at that point, did they change your contract to pararescue right on the spot? Do you remember?
Yeah, by the time I left basic, they had changed it to pararescue.
So you passed the pass test, they changed it, you got done with basic training. What happened after that? Did you go straight into the pararescue indoctrination course?
Went straight there. There are some horror stories about guys waiting months to class up, to start up. I lucked out and was 4 days after graduating basic that Indoc started for me.
So you started Indoc, and for those of our listeners that haven't heard of Indoc, obviously our students now go through a course called Assessment and Selection. Pararescue Indoctrination was a 2.5 month course, and it went through a crawl, walk, jog, run phase. So they would start you off with that pass test standards, 1.5 mile run, push-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups to a certain standard, your 2x25 yard underwaters, at a 3 minute interval, I believe, and then they would progress you on throughout the course, right? So every Monday you would have an evaluation where they would increase the distance, maybe 2 miles on week two, and then week three you would have to run 3 miles at a 7 minute mile per pace standard. How did you feel that you stacked up whenever you started Indoc among your peers?
Started out top third of the class.
We did finning, we did underwater knot tying. How did you feel you handled the water side of the house as somebody who didn't necessarily have experience in doing underwater confidence exercises, but had experience as a competitive swimmer? What was that like for you?
It was challenging. What it felt like for me is it is a progressive thing, but it seemed like they always kept the progression just barely out of reach. So you were hating life day in and day out, trying to keep up with the level of water confidence they were throwing at you. So every week it did get harder. Every week you got better, but it just always seemed to suck nonstop.
Was there a particular instructor that gave you a little bit more of a hard time than others that you can remember?
None of them were biased. They all hated me equally. It's a good spread of hatred going on there. I felt it from all of them. But it wasn't just me. I think they disliked every one of us equally.
How many guys did you have in your class when you started, if you can remember?
It's roughly about 90, from what I remember.
And when you graduated, how many of you were left?
5.
So that's almost a 95% attrition rate. 5 of you guys left. Do you remember any of their names that graduated with you?
Only 4 other ones.
All 4 other ones, right? So you graduated the Pararescue Indoctrination course. After that, I believe you went on to combat dive school and beyond.
Yes.
How was your experience in the pipeline?
Well, if you start at dive school, we used to go down to Key West, Florida, to the Army Special Forces School. I think we represented well, having been very well prepped. Typically, the Air Force guys led the class out there. Little younger group. Typically, SF guys are a lot older, but I think we did great there. Everybody got through without issue.
And the other personnel on the Army side of the house, correct me if I'm wrong, Isaiah, but these guys are already graduated Green Berets. They're graduated Army Rangers. A lot of them have already done deployments. And the pararescue students, the combat controller students, they are actually students. So they haven't gotten through their pipeline yet. Is that correct?
That's correct for back then.
So you guys felt like you stacked up pretty well against the Green Berets and the Rangers down there?
I think so. Great group of guys. Don't get me wrong, but yeah, we held our own.
How'd you like your time down in Key West in general?
Didn't see much of the island between push-ups and flutter kicks.
So you graduated the combat diver course. You went to Army Airborne School after that. And then did you go to HALO school after the airborne course, or did you go on to do the medical side, the EMT
went
basic?
On to medical after that.
So you did EMT basic. Was that with the University of New Mexico EMS Academy, or was there a different school in your time when you went through?
When I went through, they actually sent us to Fort Bragg to the 18 Delta course. We did what was called the short course, and by short, I mean 6 months. So all of us there got as far as the EMT paramedic and just our combat medicine, and then released back to the pipeline.
Now, at the time, Isaiah, were they getting you guys EMT paramedic national registry qualified so that if things were to not work out, or somebody were to get hurt or get discharged or whatever it is, would you be able to get a job as a civilian paramedic based on your qualifications after the Special Operations Combat Medical course that you went through at Fort Bragg?
Yeah, back then, if you had to pass that EMT paramedic civilian cert to get out of that course.
How hard was the paramedic course for you? Because I know personally, I actually failed the EMT National Registry paramedic test twice. It was the only time I got set back in the pipeline, and it set me back a good 3 months. I remember the test was accumulative, and it was also category-based. So there were categories such as operations or airway, breathing, drugs, pharmaceuticals, and if you were to fail one section of that test, you fail the entire test. So how did you feel that you did in National Registry? Were you a one and done? Or
Thankfully, it was a one and done. I think the lowest score I had on something was a 74. And as I remember, you need a minimum of 72 to pass in every category. So in one category, I squeaked by, but it worked out.
So Isaiah, after graduating the paramedic course, what'd you feel about medicine? Do you think you developed a passion for it? Did you enjoy the medical side of the career field?
After graduating, definitely glad it was over, but you do come out of there very competent and confident and ready to just go out and do your job.
So you finished the paramedic course. After that, did you go to survival school, Halo school?
Halo.
So I remember the first time I jumped out, we were at the Navy course, and you have an instructor holding on to you on either side. So you exit the aircraft, the instructors hold on to you, they make sure you get stable, and then they let go of you, and they give you a series of hand signals to tell you to do practice touches. They want you to turn left, turn right, and then eventually they point their finger out, and that's a signal for pull. So I thought I was actually getting practice touches, and you're supposed to pull at 5,000 feet. So they're giving me this sign I think is practice touches, and out of nowhere, all of a sudden, my parachute just deploys. And so it turns out one of the instructors came up and pulled my parachute for me because I burned right through 5,000 feet. So I remember getting to the ground, and there's these SAS instructors there. And they came up on the intercom, and they said, okay, Russell number 22, you're going to go ahead and jock up again, get back on the aircraft, and give it another shot. So I actually failed my first jump because I didn't pull my parachute, and I had to go back on the plane and rehack jump one. So what was it like for you the first time you jumped out of a plane? Did you kind of feel like you had a fear of heights? Did you feel like it was different? Was it an awesome experience for you? How did that feel the first time you got your knees in the breeze at Halo School?
Well, before you jump out on the first time, they put us through a week training in the wind tunnel. So you're pretty fairly decent, I guess, at flying before you're taking up the altitude. Nothing too out of the normal on the first jump. I mean, really, gravity is doing all the work, and as the instructor said, if something goes wrong, don't worry, you got the rest of your life to figure it out.
Did you have a better time in free fall, would you say, or did you have more fun steering your parachute in?
I think it changed over time. Definitely used to be the canopy, but as you got more competent in the flying, definitely got a lot funner with that.
So after Halo School, you went through SEER school, and then you went to the Pararescue Apprentice course, which is about a six-month course. Did it take you about 2 years to get through that PJ pipeline?
Yeah, roughly 2 years.
So after you graduate the PJ pipeline, where'd you get stationed after that, Isaiah?
Got sent out to Mildenhall, England.
And is that a special tactics squadron?
It is.
Can you tell us a little bit of the difference between the life of a special tactics squadron PJ and the life of a rescue squadron PJ?
I think PJ is a PJ. You get the same qualified guy in the ACC world versus the AFSOC world. I didn't notice much difference having done both.
You finished your career up at Mildenhall. Where'd you end up going after that, Isaiah?
Tucson, Arizona, 306 Rescue Squadron.
So 306 Rescue Squadron. Can you tell us a little bit about the 306 Rescue Squadron and what it was all about and just kind of the change of pace, if there was any, coming from Mildenhall to Tucson, Arizona?
Well, it's a reserve team. I think when I first got there, there was five or six full-time PJs. The difference is much smaller team, and you're kind of there supporting the part-time guys coming in.
So the reserve and the guard side of pararescue, that encompasses over half the career field when you look at how many units there actually are. And for those that don't know, pararescue is unique in the guard and reserve side of the house because you have what's called active guard and reserve personnel at those units. So the guard or reserve pays those personnel to work full time. Obviously, you couldn't have a functioning PJ team if guys were only coming in a couple times a month to jump or a couple times a quarter to shoot. You have to have guys that are coming in staying proficient all the time to keep those guardsmen and those reservists up to speed. In addition to that, you would have mission qualifying training until you could even be deployable. You would obviously deploy as a newer PJ or a newer crow, and you would come back and constantly be working on upgrade training. So what would you say, Isaiah, a typical day-to-day is as a PJ at a rescue squadron? What was your typical day at the 306th?
I think as a PJ, you've got so many qualifications you got to keep on, keep up, and keeps you busy with jumping, shooting, diving. It seems like there's always something.
And one of the advantages of the guard and reserve side of the house is in active duty, once you get through the pipeline, you create what's called a dream sheet. And on that dream sheet are maybe your top three, top five units that you want to go to. But the active duty is going to station you where the Air Force's needs are. However, on the Guard or Reserve side of the house, you're going to choose the team that you want to try out for. And it's important that those of you out there that are interested in Guard or Reserve Pararescue or Guard or Reserve Special Operations in general, you look at the 19th group or the 20th group side of the house on the Green Beret. You're going to actually contact the recruiting personnel from the unit. You're going to tell them that you're interested in trying out and that you want more information. And you'll actually try out for that unit. Versus the active duty side, you're going to get assigned to a unit. So you were actually able to choose a 306 and say, I want to go to that unit. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, with the pararescue, guard, and reserve side of the house, it's very unique because you can actually pick the unit that you want to try out for. So you would contact that individual unit's recruiting personnel and say, I'm interested in trying out for this unit. When is your next tryout? And that recruiter in particular that is assigned to that unit is going to be the one that facilitates your paperwork, gets you to MEPS, make sure you're current and qualified, and then obviously gets you into that tryout. Now, typically these tryouts are going to be extremely challenging because these Guard and Reserve units want to make sure that you have what it takes before they purchase your slot into the pipeline. Now, a lot of you will be asking, well, is the Guard or Reserve pipeline the same for Green Beret, for Pararescue, for TACP? Yes, the pipeline is exactly the same. However, you have somewhat of a proving grounds to go through in an interview process so that that unit can pick you up. So the Guard or Reserve side of the house is highly selective, and it is an advantage if you are trying to choose the unit that you want to go to. For example, if you want to be a Special Tactics Squadron PJ and you want to be guaranteed to be a STS side of the house, then you can try out for the 123rd Special Tactics Squadron or the 125th Special Tactics Squadron or the 306th Rescue Squadron out of Tucson, Arizona, 308th Rescue Squadron out of Cocoa Beach, Florida. You have that decision so that if you have a family or whatever it is, you know where you're going to be stationed. So that is an advantage of Guard and Reserve. And then, of course, another advantage is options. So you get to the team, you finish your mission qualifying training, which allows you to be deployable. You do your first deployment, you come back, you're doing your upgrade training. Maybe it's been four and a half years that you've been on active duty orders, and then you're faced with the decision, do I want to do this part-time or do I want to do this full-time? And at that point, you can apply for one of these active Guard Reserve slots where you're full-time at your Guard Reserve team. You can say, I want to go active duty. You can be a part-time reservist and go to school or work a contracting job or some other appropriate job that you're qualified for. Or you can say, you know what, I want to do this full-time. I didn't get an AGR slot. I'm going to cross over to active duty. So the options are there. And then, of course, those of you that know about the 24th Special Tactics Squadron, if you don't know what that is, Google it. There's a lot of information about it out there. That is the Tier 1 Special Tactics Squadron on the Air Force side of the house. And that is a tryout process in its own. The cream of the crop, tip of the spear, PJs, combat controllers, and now Special Reconnaissance personnel, and even TACP can apply for this and go through a highly selective selection process to become a Tier 1 operator. So you transferred to the 306 from your time at the STS in Mildon Hall. Was there any type of difference, would you say, from an STS unit to an RQS unit?
I didn't notice any difference in the guys. You got the same PJ as a PJ. I think they were all just as good on either side.
At the 306, Isaiah, were you actually a reservist working part-time or were you working full-time at that reserve unit?
I had done both. Started out full-time, and then when I eventually made the decision to go combat rescue officer, I went part-time just to finish up college a little quicker.
How long have you been a pararescueman before you commissioned and went the combat rescue officer route?
By the time I got my degree, it was right about 10 years enlisted.
You got your degree in 2008, is that correct?
Yes.
So you've been a PJ first for about 10 years. What'd you get your degree in?
It's out of Embry-Riddle. It's just an aeronautical degree.
And that's up in Prescott, Arizona, correct?
It is, but they had a satellite campus down in Arizona, so I'd go there when I was in town.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you were able to balance that lifestyle and still get your degree at the same time?
That is initially why I went to part-time, just because I could take off the workload and concentrate more on school. So I think the first year I did about 210 days with a full load of school and ended up being too much. It's kind of like a walking zombie. So I bumped it down to about 100 days. I worked the next year. Just, I would say, take the load you can take that'll allow you to reach whatever goal it is you're looking for.
Were you using the post 9/11 GI Bill to get your degree?
I was.
The post 9/11 GI Bill will allot you BAH. They'll pay for your tuition, obviously, and your books, and give you that opportunity for 4 years of college. Is that correct?
Yes.
So you knocked the degree out. And at that point, did you go to officer training school or OTC, officer training course? What is it called in the Air Force?
I went to the last class of what they called back then AMS, and it used to be a reserve commissioning program that lasted 6 weeks as opposed to the 12-week active duty one.
So it was an accelerated course. You knocked it out in 6 weeks. And after that, you had to go to a course called Phase 2. Is that correct for Crow selection before you actually would go to the NDOC course?
Yeah, Phase 2 came before getting commissioned because they wanted to make sure that you had a billet to go into before they sent you to officer school.
And Phase 2, correct me if I'm wrong, is extremely challenging, and it's supposed to be able to weed out officers that are theoretically supposed to get through NDOC by being able to get through Phase 2. Is that correct?
Yeah, you should. It's as I remember it, it's a week long, and what they did was take that week, run at ninth week graduating standards of NDOC. So if you got through that week, you should be able to go to NDOC and get through it.
Now, what do you think it would be like as an enlisted guy if your officer quit? It'd probably be a pretty bad day, huh? Because, I mean, I see students to this day, they tend to act as a team. So if one person starts quitting, especially if that's the most in-shape person, somebody's going to look at that person and say, well, if they're quitting, well, I better quit too. If they can't make it, well, you know, I'm not going to be able to make it either. If you have an officer going and quitting, that's probably going to be a bad day for the rest of your team as well. So would you say that typically the combat rescue officer candidates were cream of the crop compared to the rest of the candidates?
When I went through NDOC, obviously there were no Crows back then, and I've never seen any of them perform in NDOC itself. But what I saw at Phase 2, I was very impressed with the caliber of Crow they were getting through or graduating. And I have no doubt anyone that graduated Phase 2 would get through NDOC. And I don't know of any officer that's quit after that. Do you know of any, or have you heard of any?
I've never heard of an officer that's quit after getting through Phase 2. I've heard of officers washing out, but by no means quitting. So the course is proven. It's putting through a solid product, and these guys are getting through. Can you remember what your biggest challenge was as a transition from enlisted to officer side?
Not really any physically in Phase 2, but I think having had all your friends enlisted, there is the challenge of not being buddy-buddy with them when you get back. You're just in a completely different role, and that's why they have all the rules about fraternization, and it's just different. And the guys you went out drinking a beer with, you might be writing paperwork for when they're doing something stupid the next day. So it's just, I think the biggest challenge was separating yourself from enlisted guys that you'd been hanging out with for years.
And Isaiah, you did 10 years as a PJ, and then you crossed over to become a Crow, obviously commissioned, made it through Phase 2. What motivated that? And was there something that you were looking to get out of that? Were you looking to make change for the career field? Were you looking for a new challenge? What do you think your motive was to commission and become a Crow?
Definitely always up for the new challenge. It was fairly new career field. A lot of change going on there. It looked like something I wanted to be a part of. Figured from that side I'd be able to implement some of the changes I thought should have happened. But coming in as a 01, you're not going to change anything. You got wickets to climb and things to go through before you have any kind of voice of change, I think.
What did you feel the largest difference of being a combat rescue officer was versus being a senior enlisted PJ?
I think the biggest difference is your PJ is basically doing your down and in, the guys on the ground doing the tactical part of it, whereas a Crow, you're the up and out, just the command and control.
So Isaiah, you did 10 years as an enlisted PJ, then you commissioned and became a combat rescue officer, and then you started feeling a drive for something different, and you ended up actually going to the Navy and being the oldest person as a SEAL officer candidate to ever graduate BUDS.
Can you talk a little bit about what inspired you to cross over into the Navy after being 10-year enlisted PJ and a 4-year crow?
Yeah, while I was a crow, I went to a Navy course called a JOTC, Junior Officer Training Course. As far as being the oldest officer, I have not heard of an older one, though we haven't asked every single SEAL out there. So be careful with throwing that one out. But while I was a crow, I went to a JOTC, which is a Junior Officer Training Course. And when SEAL officers going through BUDS, once they pass BUDS, they go through this course. It's essentially another selection for them. If a potential SEAL officer doesn't get through that course, their career is done as a SEAL. So it's another wicket they have to get through. But while in that course, I was pretty impressed at how they use their junior officers. It's a big part of what convinced me to switch over.
So Isaiah, the PST standards are pretty high for a SEAL officer. So would you say you were in probably some of the best shape of your life when you were 35, 36 years old?
For the PST, I think anything you spend a lot of time on doing, you're going to get good at. So I specifically tailored all my training towards those events on that PST.
And for those of you that aren't aware of just how challenging these Navy SEAL officer standards are, to optimize the PST, you're looking at an 825 on the 500-yard swim, combat side stroke. You're looking at 98 push-ups, 91 sit-ups, 21 pull-ups, and an 859 on the 1.5-mile run. How'd you feel you stacked up on those optimum standards, Isaiah? Do you feel that our students should be focused on the PST to ensure readiness for BUDS?
Going to BUDS as an officer is highly competitive, and if you don't have those scores at a minimum, then your chances of getting in are greatly reduced. So as an officer, initially you have to put a lot of time into crushing those scores and then transitioning how you're training once you're picked up. At least that's how I did it.
Now, I remember you saying you had some stud athlete in your class that set a record on the obstacle course, and then he quit on the first iteration of surf torture. Can you talk a little bit about why maybe you see some of these incredible athletes coming through the course, but then they get out there to the open water or they get to the pool and then they quit? What do you think is the reason behind that, Isaiah? And what are we looking for a solid student going to BUDS?
Yeah, I don't know if they actually keep a record for the obstacle course, but he was just the individual, the fastest guy I ever seen do it, and the fastest I had heard of.
Do you remember what his time was?
I think he was about 4.5 minutes.
Wow.
And I'd say around at least 6.5, 7 is a very fast, respectable time. So this guy was smoking it.
So do you remember your first iteration of surf torture? So you're out there, you're on the Pacific Ocean, you're in the grinder, you're chafed up, you're covered in sand. Do you remember the first time when your instructors told you to link arms and hit the surf?
I do remember the first time, and the first time is actually sort of a familiarization with it. So you're not in trouble the first time you're getting it. You're just getting used to the calls to do it. And so, yeah, we all linked hands, and it was kind of smoking and joking and laughing about it. And I remember pretty quickly all the laughter died. The chattering of teeth started, and it got pretty miserable pretty quick.
Now, they don't let you guys get deep enough in the water to where you kind of get used to it, like getting in an ice bath. They put you guys right there to where the waves are just going to constantly crash over. You get wet, and then the water subsides. You get dry again real quick, and then the waves just keep hitting you, right? So there's really no way around it. There's no way to get warm. Is that correct? You just gotta tough it out.
That is correct. It's a complete mental game at that point.
If you could give any recommendation to students that are training for BUDS, what would you tell them that would be best for them to do and focus on for preparation?
I think my recommendations would be the same for any selection course you're going through, be it BUDS or NDOC or whatever, is basically do some research. The information is out there, whether you're going to BUDS or NDOC, find out what fin they're using, get a hold of that fin, train with it. That's what you're getting tested on. If you're getting tested in the pool, do your practice in the pool. If you're getting tested in open water, find a lake, find an ocean, find the distance, and get to practice in the actual element you'll be tested in. Something I was told when I first came in is it's all mind over matter, and if you don't mind, then it don't matter. And what I mean by that is going into these selection courses, you should have already decided that come hell or high water, that career field is what you are going to do. no matter what they throw at you, how hard it gets, how tired you get, how cold and miserable you get, it shouldn't matter. It's all mental at that point. Most people that go through these things can physically get through it. It's just a mental game.
So would you say that there was a certain point where it didn't matter what they threw at you, you guys were just going to take it once you got down to that core nucleus of that team?
Yeah, I'd say the guys that get through any of these selections, they've already decided that before they got there.
What was one of the most challenging elements of BUDS for you, Isaiah, especially versus what you saw on the pararescue side of the house? What were some of the differences and those unique challenges that you experienced at BUDS later on in your life going through the course?
I think the big factor in BUDS was the age. I went through NDOC at 18 and went through BUDS started at 35. So obviously my recovery time took a lot longer. I think the way BUDS set up too, you really don't get to recover. You kind of just get tore down week after week, day after day.
So you and I both went through the pararescue course where you had these evaluations every Monday. And these evaluations, you knew exactly what the distance was. So you knew it week 10, you were going to have to be able to do a 6 mile run in 44 minutes or less. At week one, you're going to have to do a 1.5 mile run at a given time. Based on what you've told me about BUDS, it was a little bit different. So you'd have a 4 mile beach run per se, and maybe the front half or the solid runners, when they'd finish, they get some rest, pays to be a winner. But then all the rest of the guys that finished behind them that are already behind the power curve, they would get a little extra torture and a little extra beat down. Kind of the culture of BUDS is those top guys are going to continue to get more rest and continue to be on top, and those dudes that are at the lower power curve are going to continue to get beat. Is that safe to say about BUDS versus maybe the NDOC side of the house? Your weaker guys are going to hold your team back and the whole team is going to pay for them. What would you say maybe the cultural difference was?
It's pretty accurate for BUDS. It did seem like the top group, which I was not a part of, did get to take a little break, and I do specifically remember when those guys relaxing while I got beat for being more towards the back.
Now, boats on heads is one of the most challenging parts of the course. How did you feel? Did you feel like there were guys on your boat team or your boat crew that were putting in more work than others? So we've had students that are 2-3 inches taller than the other guys on their boat crew, and they're getting blasted, getting a lot more weight on their head versus others. Can you give a recommendation to our students if they happen to be on a boat crew and they're a little bit taller than others, maybe how they can survive that evolution?
Well, they do a height line before you do any boats on heads iteration. So they line it up best they can to get you with guys that are your height. But once in a while it does happen, there's somewhat of a mismatch.
What do you think was your hardest challenge at BUDS and Hell Week in particular, Isaiah?
It's a long week. I think I had the age factor against me, just the recovery times.
And Isaiah, do you think that there was anything else as far as being an older guy that held you back? I say that because we see students that come through our Hell Weekends and our Hell Days, and some of them are a little bit older, some of them are a little bit younger, but typically we see with the older candidates is that they're a little bit more analytical. They think a little bit more before they do things, which can sometimes be a good thing, but sometimes can be a bad thing, right? Whenever you need to just react, you just need to jump in to the evolution instead of thinking about it and thinking why it may make sense or why it not makes sense. Did you see any change in your resiliency or maybe your gung-ho mentality as you got older? Did you have to think about things a little bit more? Did you feel like that you were a little bit more mature and better prepared as an older student going through BUDS?
I'll say in BUDS as an officer, you really can't be the gray man. You're in the spotlight all the time. Same with NDOC. But I think gray man, as an enlisted guy, you can get away with a little longer in the beginning while there's a lot of people and they can't quite concentrate on who's who. But as the numbers dwindle, if you're the gray man, you will get caught and you will get it handed to you for not stepping up.
And the gray man would essentially be that person that's not getting highlighted by the instructors, right? So that person's kind of blending in, getting the job done. Do you think BUDS, would it be a good strategy for you to go all out 100% on every evolution? Or do you hold a little bit back and kind of look at it as a marathon full of sprints? How did you handle that? Did you give 100% on every evolution, or were you able to pace yourself throughout the course? What was your strategy, Isaiah? Especially through Hell Week in particular.
I guess someone in the strategy with thinking BUDS is a marathon, not a sprint, you definitely need to or I should say, I'll speak for myself and say I needed to pace myself. Definitely don't be in the back, but I definitely wasn't fast enough to be in the front, but there's no way I wanted to be in back getting extra attention.
And for those of you that are some of the top athletes in your class, understand that if you highlight yourself as that person that's finishing first every time and you have a bad day or you burn yourself out trying to finish first every time and your instructors see you as that performer that's always finishing first, all of a sudden you have a day where you're not finishing first anymore. Those instructors are going to know and they're going to be calling you out and saying, where you at? So is it more advantageous, do you think, Isaiah, to try to be that guy that's always finishing first? Or do you think it would be better to kind of hold back a little bit and maybe stay in that top third? What are your thoughts on that and how to handle yourself in that whole endurance aspect of the course?
For me personally, it was to hold back a little. Not true of other guys that can handle that pace for that for 6 months straight. Some guys could do it. They were phenomenal athletes there that they could do that, and more power to them. I personally could not. So I had to throttle back a little bit.
And how would you contrast the team aspect of Buds compared to the team aspect of Pararescue Indoctrination? That being said, at Pararescue Indoctrination, I remember that if one person screwed up, the entire team would have to drop with that person. So the weakest link would hold the team back. At Buds, was that the same case, or did they break you guys up into individual groups a little bit more?
There definitely were times where you paid as a team, but you'll see more of individuals paying or boat teams paying or squads paying, not the whole team at the same time.
So you guys just got done getting beat down for a week. You're covered in sand. You're sleep deprived. You only got a couple hours of sleep in 7 days, and you're all lined up. 7 days is gone. The instructors have you all gathered up, and they say Hell Week secured. What did that feel like to you to know that you had secured Hell Week as a 36-year-old man and as one of the leaders and the officers?
It was definitely a relief. It was a big, big check mark done. As I remember it, they had a clean shirt and a whole pizza waiting for each of us.
So you graduate Buds and you get to phase two. How was the pool week and the pre-dive and combat dive operations on the SEAL side of the house compared to the Air Force side of the house?
I'd have to say after 10 weeks of Indoc, the 10-week graduation standard at Indoc is harder than phase two at Buds. But the difference there is at Indoc, you progress over 10 weeks. It doesn't start out that hard. But in phase two, you're basically thrown into it without preparation. So not to say phase two is easy, because it's definitely not. But you have a little more prep going into the harder training on the Indoc side.
So you graduated phase two of Buds, and then you move on to SQT. Did you have to go through static line school again and all the Halo school again?
No, they let me out of the jump schools.
So you got to clep the jump schools, and you moved on up. You did land warfare, Arctic survival. They threw you in some ice-cold water for 10 minutes. How was that?
About the first minute of it sucks, then you kind of just go numb.
Like an ice bath?
Pretty much.
And they pull you out of the water, you're hypothermic. What happened after that?
At that point, it was an exercise in testing out your cold weather gear. So setting up your one-man tent, lighting your stove to get the heat going in there. And it's pretty good gear and system they got to where you'll eventually dry out and heat up.
You've been our special guest instructor and special guest speaker for four different hell days now. Can you talk a little bit about what you've seen out of the caliber of students at these hell days and maybe some recommendations on what you'd like to see moving forward with the strength of candidate and what they can work on to be more ready for a course like Buds or a Pararescue Assessment and Selection course?
I think a lot of what I've seen is guys not fully understanding what it is they're getting into, and kind of how I said earlier about putting some research into where you're going. Guys come to these things without knowing what gear they'd be training with or what the requirements are, what the graduating standards are. It's all basic info that they should be exceeding the graduating standard before they ever get there. I think the last thing you should be worried about is, can you physically make it? There should be no doubt in your mind that you're going to go there and crush it.
So it would be safe to say that just because you can pass the pass test, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're ready for the pararescue pipeline or ready for BUDS. Can you touch a little bit more on what these guys should be doing to train to make sure that they're ready for a course like Hell Week?
I think just doing well on a pass test will give you a false impression about what a selection course is actually about. I mean, the pass test is nowhere near physically hard as any selection will be. But I think if you can physically pass the pass test with good numbers, you can physically pass a selection. So again, it comes down to, can you mentally deal with it all? Which you are being tested mentally throughout any of these selections. And again, it's going into it already knowing that no matter what happens, this is what you want. You dig deep, you find something to hold on to it for dear life, because you will be put in situations where you'll question your choice in being there, and anything that motivated you will be out the window.
Amen to that. And we are running out of time. Thank you for your wisdom, brother. Appreciate you being on with us tonight. Know that you're a true, humble, quiet professional, and it's way out of your norm to talk about your career and to talk about yourself. So we do appreciate it very much. And for those of you that are trying to decipher a career field between being a SEAL, being a pararescueman, or maybe you're trying to figure out whether enlisting or commissioning is the best option for you, hopefully this podcast sheds some light on various topics that some of y'all may be struggling with or challenged with at this time. We have more episodes dropping soon. Be on the lookout. Also be on the lookout for our upcoming Hell Day dates for this late spring and early summer. We're going to be announcing those on Instagram, as well as dropping those on the website and posting those into our group training chats. Please take some time to write us a 5-star review if you enjoyed the podcast. And until next time, we are out.
Sound off.
Thank you.
Up. Down.
Lord.